Now, Emma Fielding reads from Tracy Borman's biography of Elizabeth I, which explores the relationship she had with the women in her life. These women brought out the best and the worst in Elizabeth, who could be loyal and kind, but also cruel and vindictive. Today we hear about the influence of her stepmother, Catherine Parr.
We are more bound to them that bringeth us up well than to our parents. For our parents do that which is natural for them, that is, bringeth us into this world, but our bringers up are a cause to make us live well in it. Elizabeth quoted these words of St. Gregory in 1549. The bringer up to whom she was referring had been in charge of her upbringing for almost 13 years, and it had a profound effect on the girl's intellectual, spiritual, and above all, emotional development. Catherine Champernowne, or Cat, as Elizabeth affectionately called her, was the daughter of Sir Philip Champernowne, a landowner who, unusually for the time, was as committed to his daughter's education as he was to his son's. Cat had joined the Lady Elizabeth's household by October 1536. She was probably then in her late 20s or early 30s, and certainly unmarried. Shortly afterwards, she was appointed governess to the three-year-old Elizabeth. Cat was an instant hit. Her keen intellect was appealing to the precocious child, and she had a lively sense of fun, which occasionally bordered on irreverence. For the first time since the death of her mother, Elizabeth had found a woman who might just be a fitting replacement. But although accomplished, Cat was also somewhat naive in the ways of the world, as well as impulsive and overly romantic. Hardly commendable qualities in a woman who had been charged with raising a king's daughter. But all eyes were now focused on England's new heir, Prince Edward. The more worrying aspects of Mistress Champernowne's character were therefore overlooked. Another preoccupation at court was who the king would take as his next wife. In less than a decade, Henry had married Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, and Catherine Howard. Elizabeth's first stepmother, Jane Seymour, and the last, Catherine Howard, had been rather distant figures. Things would be entirely different with her next stepmother. Henry's sixth wife would profoundly affect her character and outlook, helping to make her into the queen that she would one day become. Born in 1512, Catherine Parr hailed from a long line of dominant, enlightened women. Twice widowed, and by now 30 years of age, Catherine was far from flattered by the king's attentions, particularly as she had already fallen deeply in love with Thomas Seymour, brother of the late Queen Jane. But she knew to gainsay the king was fraught with danger, and her reformist family no doubt put pressure on her to carry out God's will by accepting Henry's courtship. Reluctantly, she consented to be the sixth wife of this much-married monarch. Catherine was evidently fond of children and resolved to befriend all of the king's offspring. Thanks to Catherine's influence, it was agreed that Elizabeth should share some of her lessons with Edward. But Catherine soon realised that Elizabeth was far outstripping her younger brother, so she decided that the girl needed a tutor of her own. Catherine proceeded with the appointment of William Grindal, a scholar of St. John's College, Cambridge. As a testament to everything she learned under him, Elizabeth wrote a series of letters to her stepmother that were exceptionally accomplished for an 11-year-old. In 1544, Elizabeth and her half-sister were restored to the succession by their father. Elizabeth was a princess once more, and this transformation was at least in part due to the benign influence of her new stepmother. Little wonder that Elizabeth professed love and esteem for Catherine in her first letter, assuring her that she was your most obedient daughter and most faithful servant. In late July 1544, Elizabeth hastened to Hampton Court to join her stepmother. Edward and Mary were already there. Her father was not. He was leading a military expedition to France. He had appointed his wife to reign as regent in his absence, with the full exercise of royal authority. Elizabeth looked on with awe as Catherine, who relished her newfound power, proceeded to rule in the king's name. Catherine had assumed control over a country beset by war, plague, and religious division. That she succeeded not just in avoiding catastrophe, but in establishing herself as a figure of decisive authority, is a testament to her enormous capability. All this would have been witnessed by Elizabeth, who had been raised to be in awe of her father, the king, God's representative on earth. She had also been taught that women were the weaker sex, incapable of bearing the responsibility of monarchy. And yet here was Catherine, presiding over the court with as much confidence and authority as any king. The sight of some of the most powerful men in the country bowing low before a woman was something that she would never forget. With the new year came a surprising development. Cat Champernowne married John Astley, first cousin to the late Queen Anne Boleyn, who became a valued member of Elizabeth's household. Things seemed to be settling into a comfortable pattern, and Elizabeth attended the Christmas celebrations at Greenwich in 1546. A little over a month later, everything had changed. Henry VIII, England's seemingly invincible king, was dead. Elizabeth was with her brother Edward when they received the news that their father had died. The children were said to have clung to each other and wept piteously. And if Catherine had never truly been in love with her husband, she had come to care for him deeply. Her grief was intensified by disappointment when her hopes of assuming the regency during Edward VI's minority were dashed. Catherine was afforded no role at all in the government of the realm. Thomas Seymour, the Lord Admiral, now began to renew his advances to the Dowager Queen. But Seymour was far from being a one-woman man. He'd once paid court to Princess Mary, but had been swiftly rebuffed. Cat Astley was of the firm belief that Henry had been on the point of offering the Lord Admiral his younger daughter's hand in marriage when death had robbed him of the chance. She had little to base this upon, and as Cat tried to interfere in the matter, the indiscretion and naivety of her character appeared in sharp relief. She later admitted that she had tried to further the matter while King Henry was still alive, by telling Seymour that she believed he and Elizabeth were well matched. Coming across him in St. James's Park one day, she had remarked, "I had heard it said he should have married my lady." Seymour had denied it at once, and said that the council would never allow it. Meanwhile, Catherine's feelings towards Seymour had clearly never gone away. And within 3 months of Henry's death, Catherine had married her former suitor. The Princess Mary was outraged at what she perceived to be a blatant show of disrespect to her late father. Although Elizabeth paid lip service to the same disbelief felt by the rest of the royal family, it was with telling alacrity that she accepted Catherine's invitation to go and live with her at Chelsea. Elizabeth was blossoming into a striking young woman. She was an alluring prospect to any suitor, and a fatally irresistible one to her stepfather. According to Cat's later testimony, early one morning she and her charge were shocked by the sudden appearance of the Lord Admiral in Elizabeth's bedchamber. All innocence, he smilingly told them that he had come to bid his stepdaughter good morrow. Elizabeth already seemed infatuated with Lord Seymour and was seen to blush whenever he was spoken of. Cat, meanwhile, was evidently excited by such intimacy and gave little thought to its inappropriateness. Before long, Seymour's morning visits to Elizabeth's bedchamber had become a regular habit, and the more often he came, the more outrageous his behaviour grew. Cat realised too late the dangers this flirtation could bring to her 14-year-old protégé. In vain she tried to restrain the Lord Admiral as he came again and again to Elizabeth's bedchamber, dressed only in his nightgown. She reprimanded him that it was an unseemly sight to come so bare-legged to a maiden's chamber, He stormed out in anger. Kat knew that he would be back, and she decided to tell Lady Catherine. At first, Catherine dismissed Mistress Astley's concerns, but offered to accompany her husband on his morning visits. However, rather than restraining him, Catherine became an accomplice to his jests. On one occasion, pinning back Elizabeth's arms as her husband cut the girl's dress into 100 pieces. What on earth had possessed this otherwise astute woman? By this time, Catherine was pregnant with Seymour's child. She may have known full well that her husband's attentions towards Elizabeth were motivated by lust. She knew, too, that he lusted most after that which remained out of his grasp. She may have judged that the best way to cure him of his infatuation was to allow him the prize that he sought. Of course, she had no intention of permitting him to gain the ultimate victory of sleeping with Elizabeth, but she was apparently willing to let him taste just enough of her charms to sate his appetite. If such it was, then her plan backfired spectacularly. By the spring of 1548, Seymour's behaviour had got so out of hand that his wife summoned Kat Astley and instructed her to take more heed and be, as it were, in watch betwixt the Lady Elizabeth and the Admiral. Things finally came to a head when Catherine went in search of her husband and stepdaughter and came suddenly upon them where they were all alone, he having her in his arms. Outraged at being so deceived, she ordered Elizabeth to leave her house at once. Elizabeth's dismissal from Catherine's household brought her immediately to her senses. The realization of how close she had come to putting her reputation in danger made her resolve never to be so reckless in the future. There has been speculation that Elizabeth was pregnant with Seymour's child. But stories such as this were forever being put forward where members of the royal family were concerned. However, it was enough that people were merely speculating that Elizabeth had been defiled. In this first real test of her abilities as a guardian, Kat Astley had failed miserably. There is no trace of any lingering hostility in the letters Catherine Parr and Elizabeth exchanged after their separation in June 1548. A few weeks later, the 30th of August, Catherine was delivered of a girl, christened Mary. But she fell prey to that most dreaded of childbed illnesses, puerperal fever. In her delirium, she ranted against her husband as he stood by her bedside with her ladies. Seizing her husband's hand, she cried, "I'm not well handled. For those that be about me careth not for me, but standeth laughing at my grief. And the more good I will to them, the less good they will to me." Catherine died on the 7th of September. It was Seymour who sent news of her death to Elizabeth. There is no record of her reaction, but the fact that she was shortly afterwards reported to be gravely ill suggests that the news had affected her badly. Grief at the loss of her stepmother was no doubt mingled with guilt at the thought of the pain she had caused her. This guilt would have been intensified when she heard of Catherine's unquieted mind as she ranted against Elizabeth and Seymour for so betraying her.
Emma Fielding reading from Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman. It was abridged by Katie Nicol and produced by Elizabeth Allard. And tomorrow we'll hear about the role played by ladies of honour and ladies in waiting.